Welcome to Hollywood in Color, where I tell the stories of the stars usually left out of entertainment history, the people of color in front of and behind the camera who have been representing for over a century. I'm your host, Diana Martinez. In the 1930s, after a series of big, big scandals, Hollywood needed to revamp its image and fix its reputation as a debauched town and industry catering to the vices of the rich. Not only did Hollywood need to overhaul its system of keeping actors' off-screen antics in check, they needed to make sure their product, the films themselves, were equally palatable. So Hollywood faced a dilemma. Either wait for the government to censor film content, or establish some form of self-censorship and rebrand as wholesome entertainment. Hollywood chose the latter, and through a new bureaucratic branch, it created the Hollywood Production Code, a kind of checklist of do's and don'ts to keep films in line with the moral compass of upstanding Americans. Now, there's a misconception that the Hollywood Production Code of the 1930s forbid certain subject matter, like adultery, prostitution, drugs and alcohol, violence. But in fact, the code was a list of things studios should stay away from if they wanted approval from the Production Code Administration. If they didn't have that approval, it would be very, very difficult to convince theaters to play the film. But there were ways around the code and the administration. There were only two things that were actually forbidden in writing. Number one was called sex perversion, which was code for homosexuality. And number two was miscegenation, defined as the sex relationship between the white and black races. The production code, as all things, was not created in a bubble. It was a reaction to prevailing ideas about race and sexuality, while it simultaneously shaped the representation of race and sexuality. The production code informally carried on into the golden era of Hollywood and became a part of film's visual language long after it was gone. It became deeply encoded as tradition, convention, and artistic practice. We can still see the influence of the production code in film and television today. Things that the code only loosely regulated, like violence, vice, and acts of white sexuality, were gradually allowed to become a more prominent part of the things we watch. The only taboos that have remained in film, really and truly, are those things that the code forbade. Romantic, physical, queer or interracial intimacy. In the 1930s, there were films about so-called mixed couples, but these stories functioned as cautionary tales. At the end, someone ended up miserable, someone was punished, someone died, and that was okay. What wasn't okay was love, loving embraces, hand-holding, kisses, a happy ending. Of course, the representation of interracial relationships was an effect of the very real legislation that prohibited interracial marriage. That changed in 1967 with the passing of Loving versus Virginia. That same year, the film Guess Who's Coming to Dinner premiered. The film centers around a young couple played by Sidney Poitier and Katherine Houghton. They visit her white parents and attempt to convince them that their love is good and decent. At the end of the film, the couple wins the blessing of the patriarch, played by Spencer Tracy.
I'm sure you know what you're up against. There'll be 100 million people right here in this country who will be shocked and offended and appalled at the two of you. And the two of you will just have to ride that out. Maybe every day for the rest of your lives. You can try to ignore those people, Or you can feel sorry for them and for their prejudices and their bigotry and their blind hatreds and stupid fears. But where necessary, you'll just have to cling tight to each other and say, screw all those people. Anybody could make a case, and a hell of a good case, against your getting married. The arguments are so obvious that nobody has to make them. But you're two wonderful people who happen to fall in love and happen to have a pigmentation problem. And I think that now, no matter what kind of a case some bastard could make against your getting married, there would be only one thing worse. And that would be if, knowing what you two are, knowing what you two have, and knowing what you two feel, you didn't get married.
By 1982, audiences had seen a few examples of what was once forbidden. But it wasn't until The Bodyguard, starring Whitney Houston in her first acting role and leading man Kevin Costner, that a mainstream film rivaling the magnitude and star power of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner made its way to theaters. The Bodyguard was not an independent film. It wasn't for a niche audience. It was made with a big budget, with stars at the height of their fame. And this time, it was not interested in the couple's race. At least, not explicitly. This is episode 2 of Sonic Cinema. Today, the making of The Bodyguard. In 1985, 21-year-old Whitney Houston released her self-titled debut album. The first single off the album was a ballad called You Give Good Love. It took some time for me to see. In 3 months, the single steadily climbed to number one on the Billboard R&B charts. It was also climbing the Billboard Hot 100 charts, and at number 3, it was a stunning debut for a new artist. But it was Whitney's second single, a cover called Saving All My Love for You, that made her into a pop sensation. To resist being last on your list, but no other man's gonna do. So I'm saving all my love for you. It was the first of 7 back-to-back number one hits.
Love. open arms of a love that's waiting there. And if somebody loves you, won't they always...
Her debut album sold 22 million copies worldwide. Her next album, released June 1987, sold 20 million as well. But there were many who thought Whitney's mainstream success was at the expense of her race. As soon as Whitney entered the public eye, she was marketed as a pop star, meaning she was distanced from black musical genres by producer Clive Davis at Arista Records. Her press tour highlighted her all-Americanness. Whitney went on talk shows and talked about her mother's singing career, her aunt, singer Dionne Warwick. Aretha Franklin was a family friend. Nepotism became a big part of her star text early on, even though these women had had no influence on Whitney's career. By tying Whitney to their legacies, producers fed audiences assumptions about Whitney's class status and pedigree. It doesn't quite make sense to say that Clive Davis sought out to make Whitney have crossover appeal or success. She was never meant to cross over from or into another genre. He sought out to make a bona fide pop diva. And despite pop music's origins in black musical forms, pop was equated with whiteness. Whitney's demeanor also played into the role created for her. She was soft-spoken, elegant. She dressed much older than her 21 years of age, and not in a sexy way. Whitney was easy listening. She was more Michael Bolton than Michael Jackson. And though Whitney's youth was not nearly as idyllic as it was painted to be in the press, all that mattered was what people were hearing, or rather, what they weren't hearing. Whitney quickly became known for her technical prowess and vocal gymnastics, but she was accused of having very little soul. At the 1989 Soul Train Awards, she was nominated for Best R&B Urban Contemporary Single by a Female. When her name was announced, the audience booed.
Nominees for Best R&B Urban Contemporary Single by a Female are...
You better win of all that has to be. I hope you see that
I'm giving you the best that I've got, Anita Baker.
And together we can calm the stormy sea.
The vocal apathy for her intensified in the months to come. Activist Reverend Al Sharpton called for a boycott of her music, calling her Whitey Houston. A year later, on a May 5th, 1990 episode of the sketch comedy series In Living Color, its fourth episode ever, the show added its commentary to the mix. The skit, called Rhythmless Nation, exploited the media-made rivalry between Janet Jackson and Whitney Houston to make its own pointed criticism of Whitney's whiteness. Janet Jackson was in many ways the opposite of Whitney. Janet, though a strong singer, was known for being a great dancer, and her performances were a spectacle of choreography, lighting, and costume. Additionally, as a Jackson, she was a bona fide R&B artist turned pop royalty. Black pop royalty. In 1986, Janet released the massive hit Control, her first musical venture without the direction of her father. For her next project, she created an album called 1814, crafted around an explicit call for social justice and racial equality. In the prelude for her album, Jackson declares the political immediacy of her music. We are a nation of no geographic boundaries, bound together through our beliefs. We are like-minded individuals, sharing a common vision, pushing toward a world rid of color lines. The interlude moves into the first single off the album called Rhythm Nation, a metaphor for a movement of young people, especially the disenfranchised, to create an activist coalition for justice and equality. The video for Rhythm Nation shows Janet and a cohort of dancers moving with the precision of an army, amplified by their all-black military-inspired uniforms. It's an iconic music video with choreography and symbolism that has been duplicated time and again. In Living Color, imagined what this video might look like with Whitney at the helm. Or rather, how funny the video would be if a rhythmless white singer tried to be black for once. It's hard to verbally describe the physical comedy happening in this scene. You really should look up this clip on YouTube. Kim Wayans, as Whitney, flails about out of time with the music. As the number goes on, she pulls out even more ridiculous, outdated dance moves. Whitney was an apolitical singer at a time when mainstream black artists were becoming bolder and decidedly more political in their work. Janet Jackson released Rhythm Nation, which commented on school shootings, poverty, drug abuse, racism, and war. NWA had become one of the most protested groups in music history, with their songs about injustice and police brutality. This is not to say that all black artists were making political music at this time. Pop and hip-hop and R&B could also be frivolous and disconnected. But there was undue pressure on Whitney. As someone who had so much success, so much access to audiences, and such a large platform to speak about subjects that matter to a black community, or to, at the very least, sound like she was proud of the legacy of black music she came up from. Months after the In Living Color sketch aired, on November 4th, 1990, Whitney released her third album, called I'm Your Baby Tonight, which was, in large part, a response to accusations of making white music. For that album, she worked with L.A. Reid and Babyface, two of the most respected producers in the industry, known for their groundbreaking work with black artists specifically. In his autobiography, L.A. Reid writes, "Whitney had a string of number one hits, but Clive felt she needed to strengthen her grounding in contemporary black music and ease up on the pop songs." The first single off the album was also called I'm Your Baby Tonight and features the snappy beats of the New Jack Swing of the late 80s and 90s without compromising her voice. The song features difficult tempo changes and is, in Reed's words, a bitch to sing. Whitney recorded the track in 1 hour. You're making me feel I can do anything for you, baby. Accompanying the release of her album was a promotion tour where she spoke candidly with several media outlets about the In Living Color sketch and the criticisms of her as not Black enough. In a December 1990 issue of Essence magazine, Whitney defiantly says, "Black? Black. That bothers me. What's Black? I've been trying to figure this out since I've been in the business. I don't know how to sing Black, and I don't know how to sing white either. I know how to sing. Music is not a color to me. It's an art." On January 4th, 1991, in an appearance on the Arsenio Hall show, they discuss the Soul Train Awards. Though composed, there is an edge to her statements that suggests she has been deeply hurt.
"Can I ask you one serious question? Something that always..."
"How serious is it?"
"Well, it's not about your personal life. It's about a little professional thing that always bothers me."
"Oh, really?"
"What is the deal in the past when you've had the friction at the Soul Train Awards? Where does that come from? For those of you who don't know..."
"They boo me at Soul Train Awards."
"Yeah, and I'm not exactly sure. You know, you can't ask a whole crowd, 'Excuse me, was there a meeting that I missed? What was that about?'"
"Yeah. Yeah, I want to say that and some other things, but... I don't really know what it's about, but I think that I've got a lot of flack, you know, about I sing too white, or I sing, you know, I sing white or something like that, you know. So I think that maybe that's where it comes from. I don't know. You know, I haven't had the time to ask why I get booed at the Soul Train Awards, but I grew up on Soul Train just like every other Black kid."
"Wait, first of all, you sang the way God planned for you to sing. That's number one.
Number
that's number one.
Thank you.
And I'm not exactly sure what singing white is, but I don't know,
maybe
there is more soul to be offered than what you give.
How will I know if he really loves me?"
"Yeah.
I don't know. I don't get it. I don't either, but I do sing the way God intended for me to sing, and I'm using what he gave me, and I'm using it to the best of my ability."
We'll be right back with Whitney and...
In a May 1991 issue of Ebony magazine, Whitney is the most confessional. She says, "They might have said Whitney is danceless nation, but rhythmless? No, not in a million years. How could I come from where I've come from and be rhythmless? And don't say I don't have soul or what you consider to be Blackness. I know what my color is. I was raised in a Black community with Black people, so that has never been a thing with me. Yeah, I've gotten flack about being a pop success, but that doesn't mean that I'm white. Pop music has never been all white." She goes on, "My success happened so quickly that when I first came out, Black people felt she belongs to us. And then all of a sudden, the big success came and they felt I wasn't theirs anymore, that I wasn't within their reach. It was felt that I was making myself more accessible to whites, but I wasn't." It was easy, if you were outside certain circles, to not know that there were people who thought Whitney was disingenuous or bland or soulless, because in mainstream entertainment, she reigned supreme. The Whitney had been popular before I'm Your Baby Tonight. In 1991, she achieved iconic status. She was nicknamed The Voice, and having firmly conquered the music world, it was time to try her hand at acting. The Bodyguard, a film about an entertainer who falls in love with her bodyguard, had been in development since 1976. Written by Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark and co-wrote Star Wars Episode 5 and 6, The Bodyguard was conceived as a star vehicle for Diana Ross and Steve McQueen. It's unclear how or why that project fell apart. There are three commonly cited reasons you'll find online, but they've all proven pretty difficult to corroborate with a reliable source. But here they are. First is that Steve McQueen was too sick to make the film. However, the script was being shopped around to studios and rejected as many as 66 times as early as 1976. And McQueen wasn't officially diagnosed with cancer until 2 years later in 1978, after the script would have been offered to him. On some accounts, McQueen never even saw the script of The Bodyguard. The second reason is plausible, though also difficult to verify. Supposedly, there was a dispute over who, Diana Ross or Steve McQueen, would get top billing on the film. Without any compromise, it was difficult for the project to get off the ground. The third reason typically given is that the film was set to go, but ultimately, an interracial pairing was deemed too scandalous by the studio. It's unclear whether Lawrence Kasdan ever intended the film to be about an interracial couple. Kasdan, to my knowledge, has never discussed on the record the early versions of the script. However, there is one source that suggests race was a significant factor in the script as early as 1981. In Diana Ross' biography by J. Randy Taraborelli, the author discusses Ross's involvement in the film. However, his timeline begins about 2 years after Kasdan first sells his script. According to Taraborelli, in 1978, actor Ryan O'Neill replaced Steve McQueen as a contender for the role of Frank Farmer, the bodyguard. O'Neill then pursued Diana Ross as his co-star. Taraborelli says, "In its earliest incarnation, The Bodyguard was envisioned as a musical drama about a black superstar singer who begins receiving death threats and therefore decides to hire protection. She interviews dozens of men for the job, most of whom are black and strong, but ultimately she chooses a white guy, not because of his physique, but because of his sharp instincts. While her and the bodyguard are evading her stalker, they leave town and fall in love." According to Taraborelli, Ryan O'Neill's determination to get Diana Ross to play the part leads to their real-life romance. However, they personally and professionally hit an impasse when Ross realizes the script has a nude scene. She refuses to do the scene, and Ryan O'Neill tries to argue that nudity is non-negotiable. She has to do it. By August of 1979, O'Neill becomes tired of Ross's unwillingness to do the film, and their romance becomes strained. Taraborelli says that Ross didn't like the nudity, the film's violence, and the unnecessary foul language. O'Neill was pissed. And soon after, Ryan O'Neill tells the LA Times, "All of a sudden, she didn't want to play a woman guarded by a white bodyguard because Diana Ross doesn't want to show her body, doesn't want to do sex scenes on the screen, doesn't want to sing, and doesn't want to be black. So as you can see, we are no longer an item." Essentially, O'Neill was accusing Ross of what Whitney would also be accused of: not using her body, not using her sexuality, and therefore not being proud of her race. When actor Kevin Costner resuscitated the project in 1992, there was a long list of women Warner Brothers wanted to consider for the role of Rachel Maron in The Bodyguard. In interviews then and now, Costner is adamant that it was a colorblind casting process. The list of considered actresses does show that he and the studio did not necessarily seek out a black singer for the role. Madonna, Olivia Newton-John, Dolly Parton, Pat Benatar, and Janet Jackson were all considered. But producer Kevin Costner wanted Whitney Houston, so he offered her the part, then waited a year for her answer.
"After the second album, I started thinking, maybe I'll do a movie someday, I didn't have any idea who or what, or any of those things that most people know, I guess, when they, start out looking for a film or project that they want to do. I had no idea. So being that I had no idea, I just thought, well, I'll just wait for that right one to come along. And if it does, hey, great. And if it doesn't, well, cool, But it did, there was The Bodyguard. I kind of sat on it for a while, for a long while. I think longer than somebody who really wanted to do it would have said,
I called her, I said, I have this movie. You're who I'm thinking of. I'm not thinking of anybody else. It's almost yours to lose or to take. Why don't you read this? And she called me back and she got it. She understood.
Something hit me one day and it said, well, you know, Whitney, there will probably never be another role like this for a woman, especially a black woman, to do.
On November 25th, 1992, The Bodyguard premiered. It debuted at number 3 at the box office, bringing in almost $17 million in the U.S. Whitney recognized how monumental it was for her to star alongside one of the most powerful movie stars at the time. In this interview and others, she mentions the importance of being a black romantic lead in a large studio production. In the years leading up to The Bodyguard, there were several movies featuring interracial couples, such as White Nights, 1985, Fatal Beauty of 1987, Angel Heart, also of 1987, Harlem Nights in 1989, and Jungle Fever in 1991. And none of these films had the publicity, budget, or wide appeal of The Bodyguard. The Bodyguard has, in more recent years, been reassessed in the context of its colorblind politics, where race doesn't just not matter, it doesn't exist. Granted, the movie's lack of engagement with race isn't ideal. But in an interview with ABC News, Costner speaks briefly about how scared the studio executives were to make a film that didn't somehow explain to the audience how these two very attractive people might be into each other. It is easy, in retrospect, to see how the approach Costner took whitewashed what could have been a really interesting depiction of interracial romance. As much as they wanted to ignore it, race does shape our relationships with others. But we also have to try to see how this colorblind version of the film was a somewhat rebellious fuck you to studio executives who were convinced that Whitney's race would be an issue, who thought audiences wouldn't go see a black-white romance, no matter if it starred two of the biggest stars of the time. By the end of the year, the film was America's seventh highest grossing film and the second highest grossing film of 1992 in the world. The Bodyguard soundtrack was without a doubt one of the reasons for the movie's success. It has since gone 18 times platinum and is still the best-selling soundtrack of all time. Whitney was executive producer on the album, along with prolific record producer Clive Davis. The soundtrack had a mix of ballads and dance tracks like Queen of the Night, Run to You, I Have Nothing, and I'm Every Woman. But the soundtrack featured one song. The song that would be forever associated with Whitney and would cement her status as an icon.
If I should stay, I would only be in your way.
But I Will Always Love You wasn't going to be the featured song of The Bodyguard. Here is producer David Foster, who also worked on the soundtrack, talking about the original song they had in mind for the film.
I didn't even know the song. I'd never heard of it before, but we had picked the song What Becomes of the Brokenhearted. And although on the surface, what becomes of the brokenhearted? But I sat in my studio and I did not one, but two demos of that song. Played the demos for her, and she would go, really? Do we really have to do this song? I mean, it's a nice song, but it's just not right for me. And I felt the same way.
Kevin Costner brought Whitney and Foster a recording of Dolly Parton's I Will Always Love You, a country love song. Foster immediately loved the idea, envisioning how he could transform it for Whitney's big voice, strings, an epic key change. But something was still missing, a quiet moment. Costner suggested to drop away all the instrumentation from the beginning of the song. The song should begin a cappella. Once again, the record executives doubted that anyone would play a song on the radio that began with no music. But after the song was recorded, they couldn't deny that the intimacy Whitney's voice created was special and rare. The song plays a crucial part at the end of the film, a moment that is as special and groundbreaking as the soundtrack itself. At the end of the film, Frank, having finished his duty and saved her life, leaves Rachel. They stand outside a tarmac and say their goodbyes.
So you're putting show business, huh?
Yeah.
Too bad. You had talent. Why'd you go to the plane? Go.
So how's the new guy?
He's got white hair, Frank.
He's very good.
Yeah, but did you have to get me an old man?
I don't trust you.
Yeah, well, let's get this over with, okay? Give me a kiss.
Goodbye, Rachel.
Rachel gets on the plane.
I should stay. I would only be in your way. So I go.
You okay?
Yeah. But I know I'll think of you every
step. She looks back at Frank. His arm is in a sling. The plane starts to take off.
Wait!
And suddenly she runs off the plane and into his arms. As they kiss, the camera whirls around them. In an article for the New York Times, law professor Kevin Noble Maylard writes, "Interracial love is the complicated, unacknowledged silence of the American past. It is the duty of film and art to fill these narrative voids. The overwhelming lack of these stories on screen reveals a tacit, cinematic apartheid that insists upon racial separation. The absence of these accounts wordlessly validates the impossibility of integration at the most intimate, personal level." The final kiss in The Bodyguard is every bit old Hollywood. Even the costuming, his brown suit and her silk headscarf, has a glamorous quality that evokes the past. It is not their first kiss in the film, but it is the fairy tale moment. It's an affair to remember. It's Casablanca. The whirling camera gives us a sense of the world fading away, leaving only the couple in the center of our screen. This scene, in its deeply conventional style, is one of the most radical of the film because it rewrites the love stories we know, using the conventions of film's past. As much trouble as the producers went to ally to the interracial romance at the heart of the film, this moment makes it inescapable because you're forced to see it. The camera centers on it. Cinematic time stops. You're made to feel their love through Whitney's soaring voice, and you're made to want love like that. And that is the power of film. To fill narrative voids, of course, but also to show us all the different iterations of love that may fulfill our own lives. This episode of Hollywood in Color has been produced, edited, and narrated by me, Diana Martinez. All artwork for the show was designed by Shelby Mooring. If you like the show, please recommend it to others in a visible space, in a review, a tweet, or a Facebook post, whatever you can think of. And with that said, I can't wait to tell you another story very soon.